Welcome back to Sweet Pea Podcast, The Early Years, with your host, Loretta McDonough. Today I'm in Galway in GMIT on the Dublin Road, and it's a very wet morning, but it's fresh, as they say, down the west. And I'm here to meet a lady called Mary Skillington. And so we're sitting here, so I'd like to say good morning, Mary.
Good morning, Loretta. Thanks for the invite.
Oh, you're very welcome. And I first heard this lady talking in as for childminding. But first of all, Mary, I'd like to talk about you and how you got here and how you're lecturing in GMIT over there in Mayo. And what's your story?
Yeah, so I guess I had my son in 1999, and I just decided at the time to go back and do a degree. So I'll very quickly, I did my degree in London at the time. And after
Were you living there?
I was living in London.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah. Geez, that's great. No. Very committed to be going backwards and forwards.
It was great. I did a part-time over 6 years at the London Metropolitan University. And then I moved back to Ireland and I managed a service in rural Mayo. And then I went on to work with the IPPA and did some workshops for the IPPA. And then they merged with the NCNA at the time and they became Early Childhood Ireland. So I worked with Early Childhood Ireland for a while, again, delivered a level six, and I did some workshops around the country, some support. And after that, then I went to working with Better Start in a mentoring role. So I was working in the West and was one of their quality specialists. And then after about a year and a half, I applied for a job in GMIT on the Mayo campus. They had a new program in early childhood education and care, and I was really lucky to get the post. So I've been there for 3 years now, lecturing in early years.
And going back to London, were you working in childcare in London at the time?
No, I was doing placement, which was really great. I was working in central London in Paddington in a huge creche, but run by an amazing lady. So I really, she was a very wise elder, is really the best way I could describe her. Oh, her practice was amazing. I was just really lucky to get working there. And it was my first experience of working in a service. And it was very, a creche in the middle of a lot of high-rise flats, very diverse group of children, parents. And the way they did things was amazing. Every morning at 8 o'clock, there was a meeting. Everybody came together, the start of the day, talked about the day, very grounded in reflection and reflective practice.
That's brilliant, because like, that was way before its time. And like to have that hour before you start for everybody to be kind of on the same wavelength and know what's happening actually during the day.
Oh, absolutely. It really was. And I guess it made me value the importance of that. People would start to understand a child's situation, somebody new coming in. They were very good at following children's lines of inquiry. It was very much that woodwork area, huge, big, lots of different rooms with lots of different things going on.
Lovely.
It was
great.
Yeah.
Very different to what you came to in Mayo then, the rural.
Absolutely. I came from that to one room with the jigsaw flooring, in a very rural part of Mayo. But again, it was really great. I brought that experience with me. We again always followed quite an emergent curriculum, because I was always into creativity and play. Huge value on play. I just think it's so underrated, because it's so hard for us to define, but we all know what it feels like. So I was there for a while, and then I decided to open my own service in Westport with a partner.
Preschool or daycare?
Preschool.
Preschool, yeah.
So it was a preschool session. We were in an old school with the run of the school, and we had a room dedicated to creative arts. So it was set up in five areas with the help of Lucy Hill, who set it up. So we had a drawing area, a clay area, a painting area, a 3D area and printing area. And this was back in early 2000s. And Lucy worked with us to do workshops. And I learned so much from her as well.
And did she work with you with the children, or, you know, while you were there? Yeah.
Yeah, with the children. So, like, she might come up with an idea to hang voile in the room and use pegs, or have tires in the room with lots of fabric. Just lots of different ideas. Yeah. And then we'd just watch and we'd video the children and see how they engaged with it. And they were so motivated and they were so interested, and it was just amazing to see what came out of that. And she'd been working for years with the Terrific Twos toddlers. She'd been working, so she'd great experience. And we still have a relationship to this day.
Isn't that lovely? Yeah. Because I think through experience, it informs our practice.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, and you got all that great experience for yourself in London, and you brought it back and you realised that, okay, maybe we are a little bit different in London and we might have been a little bit behind at the times, or maybe not so progressive. Yeah. But your experience led your practice and brought in, like Lucy, in different ideas so that you could evolve.
Oh, absolutely. And even, like, she used to take, instead of one picture of children, she'd take three images, and just even those kind of tips for practice. So watch what a child goes to choose, take a photograph, watch as they engage in the process, take a photograph, and the end product isn't important, but you could take, so you had, you captured, you documented the process right through. Okay. And it was really, I'd never done that before, you know, or taken, but it was really a great way to capture children, and you'd see the level of involvement on their face when they were doing things. So we got really good at just taking lots of pictures, reflecting back with children on them.
As they say, pictures tell a thousand stories.
Yeah.
And with children, it really does. But it's capturing, getting them and having that phone, or, you know, having that camera device beside you when it's actually happening. It can be quite tricky sometimes in a very busy setting.
Yeah. So we just had it there all the time. At the time, it wasn't so structured, the regulations. We kind of followed our own, you know, followed the children's lines of inquiry all the time.
Stood back a lot. Without being told to by regulations. It was a natural process that you did.
Absolutely. And it's so important to stand back. That's where you learn so much. And, you know, we sometimes feel we have to be on top of children or in their play. But actually, Magda Gerber, who's a brilliant educator, said, observe more, do less, enjoy more. And it's so true. And it's a very valuable role to stand back and actually observe. It's the way you learn. You really start to see what children are interested in. Mm-hmm. And then you can follow that much, much easier.
It's a quite hard tool to do, is to just sit and observe, when we think as practitioners we should be, especially new students or new practitioners coming onto it, you think you have to be doing, or, you know, if Johnny is sitting on the mat playing with two cars, well, I need to be giving him a garage. I need to be giving him blocks to make a garage. We feel as if we always have to input on their play.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I suppose you feel that, you know, I'm being paid and I need to be. But actually just being is so important, and for children as well. And you get really good then at signals. Children will let you know if they want you to come into their play. And you'll know much better if you observe first, if you stand back and see what's happening. And just to value play, you know, I think it's really important that we really understand how valuable play is. It is a biological drive that we have. We have two drives in the brain. We have, once we're secure, if we're not secure, it's hard to explore. If we're feeling secure, we will explore. So children who don't feel secure, you will notice that they don't explore, because they're in fight, flight, freeze mode, actually. But once they are secure and once they've settled into a setting, the exploratory drive kicks in. Now, you'll see that often at mother and toddler groups, where a baby is constantly looking back to the mother, are you my secure base? Are you still there? And once they know that, they're free to explore. And that exploratory drive, play drive, is on for life.
Like, is it innate?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely innate. And a guy called Jack Panksepp, He's done amazing work on the neurobiology of the brain, but he says that play is absolutely, he has discovered a play drive. He did discover it. He was known as the rat tickler, but we do have drive to play. And if we don't play, it has actually, Stuart Brown would say it has detrimental effects. He does an amazing TED talk on play. And he would say that he looked at the histories of people who had committed terrible crimes in America, and their play history, there was a deprivation of play. Now, you know, people can look him up and listen to it, but he makes a very compelling argument for play. And I think we need to really explore, do we offer children enough opportunity, time and space just to play? You know, what value do we put on it? I really think we need to really consider that as early years educators. Or does it just get 30 minutes a day, and, you know, and is it really free play? Is it intrinsically motivated?
What is play? Is there a mixed senses of what play is, you know, within practice?
Absolutely. Huge. I mean, it is really hard to define, and lots of people have tried to define it. And I guess Ashter's definition is the broadest. They say it's a way of doing things. So we understand it's valuable, but you know what it feels like to be a player. You know, there's that sense of freedom. There's the enjoyment. You have control over what you're doing. It's all those intrinsic motivation factors. And when you see that, when you see those kind of factors, but it's, if it's not motivated, if it doesn't come from the child, I would say it's not free play. If it's, you know, if it's completely chosen by them, completely following their interest, then that's play. So you can see the enjoyment, they've control over it, they've a probability of success. And it's where creativity comes from. We play with ideas, we play with roles. That's where children learn. Like, it's where we had a little boy actually in the preschool once who had a new sibling in the family. And obviously he'd an older sister and a new sibling. For 3 weeks, we had a little bed in the preschool, like a little child's bed in the home corner at the time. And he was in the bed for nearly, honestly, most of the day. Everybody coming to him, pretending to give him a bottle. That was his way of working through having a new sibling in the family, coming to terms with it. After that, he came to terms with it and he moved on. But children need opportunities through play to deal with emotional stuff, roles. What's it like to be a mother? They're so, like, they take everything in and they test it out in play because there's no right or wrong.
Yeah, and there's no end results and nobody telling them what to do. So by reenacting, he was, what's it like to be the new baby?
Exactly.
Yeah. Let me see what it feels like for everybody to be around the new baby and to be looking at the new baby and how that felt. And then after a while, he realises it's quite boring over here. And
who knows exactly what was going on.
Maybe I want to go back over there to the tractors. You know, so it's allowing that freedom, that space and time for him to explore his own feelings.
Exactly. And really important.
And if there is difficulty or he is having little struggles with his own feelings, that's when the practitioner, through observation and observing him, can see, well, he's actually not coping very well with this. So let's see.
Yeah, you just realise that's his way of dealing with it. And he's exploring maybe the role of the new baby, maybe his role. Maybe the baby's getting a lot of attention. In the preschool, he had lots of attention with everybody going over to him.
Yes, he did.
But you need somebody to let him work through that. And that takes time. It takes space. It takes an observant adult. It takes them to value what's happening for him and to realise, you know, that he'll work through it and he'll take that on then. He'll integrate that into himself so it won't be a conflict within him. And it's through play that children deal with a lot of this. And again, because there is no right or wrong, so really, really valuable. I mean, I would say we don't give enough time to free play in even a morning session.
And, you know, so within early years education and learning and care.
Yeah.
All the headlines there.
Yeah.
And okay, there is a value on play. And we all know, a parent knows, children know.
Yeah.
A child, everybody that's involved with children would know the value of play. But do we really regard it as learning?
Exactly, yeah.
So we know the value of play. We know children are at the happiest. We know they chat and talk, even if it's just with themselves or with their whoever's yeah. nearest to them. They might communicate with an adult while they're playing. But so we do know the value of it, but do we really know the value of it towards learning and how much they learn through play?
I mean, it's really linked to holistic development and their holistic learning. It's just encompassing. It really is. I don't know if we really value it for what children learn from it. So we talk a lot even around self-regulation, and we realise children being able to regulate their emotions, their set themselves, is so key. I mean, the Centre for the Developing Child in Harvard, they talk about self-regulation, toxic stress. Actually, play is very regulating for children. So if we... I'll tell you, if you watch a child in free play, a child that can go into a role and stay in that role, she takes on the role of mummy. Okay, she's got to play. She's a play partner now. She has to stay in that role. Somebody else might take on the role of dad or the big mm-hmm. sister. Those children generally, I would say, if you see their social and emotional development, it's usually at a high level. It's so once children can play and take on those roles, they have to be a play partner. They have to have empathy. They have to be able to respond to what their player says. So actually, it's through play that the key skill that we need for the early years and for children to be able to learn, it's in play they learn those skills. Mm-hmm. And only play, I would say, are one of the only ways. They stop, start, all the skills you need and all the dispositions you learn in play. So rather than a focus on skills, thinking about cooperation, persistence, involvement. I mean, they're really the things they bring with them through their life. Mm-hmm. And we have a huge window of opportunity between 3 and 5 to develop those dispositions. So if we focus on that, we're doing children a great justice. You know, and there was a big, I suppose, in the 80s, there was a lot of research, teach your baby to read, teach your baby yes. maths and yeah. all these early skills. But just because a child can say the alphabet doesn't mean they have any understanding of it, or if they can count to 10, it doesn't mean they have any understanding of the concept of a number, of what 4 actually is. So we sometimes think that by them just rhyming it off that they somehow understand it, which is not true. So a focus on dispositions is a much deeper learning. Okay. And we're really building the skills then for children to learn throughout their whole schooling yeah. and their amazing dispositions.
And then through play, they're showing what they really understand of the world around them.
Totally. You're getting a real window of opportunity because they're saying what they're thinking. You know, the thinking yeah. hasn't become very internalised yet. And they'll all play at different levels. So you'll have a baby will pick up a block and say, what is it? And they'll push it to their cheek and they might taste it and rub it on their hand. So that's the stage they're at.
So babies are more sensory when they're playing. And is it important to encourage this play as from very early on?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know there's a big move away towards from plastic to natural materials. And that's really important because the sensory information, they get it from the material. So if it's always plastic, they're always getting a warm, same. You know, if you've got wood, if you've got metals,
stone.
If you've got yeah. stone, if you, not just that, you know,
even
if you've a variety
and, yeah,
of
yeah,
materials, then
of
that's given the brain lots of information around lots of different materials. And then if you have like for a toddler, they'll say, what is it? Can I roll it? Can I build with it? What can I do with the block? And they will work in a different way to a baby. And then as a preschooler generally or somebody in the 3 to 4, they'll say, how can I use it? OK, it's going to become part of my town. It's going to be the main hotel in my block structure. And that's the reason as well that when we're doing even small group activities, you should always have an activity that whatever level children are at, they can engage in that level. So I'll give you an example. If you give a group of preschoolers an open-ended material, like you might give them some blocks and some animals, or you might give them clay, let's say.
Yeah.
So you give them some clay, a child who's just seeing clay for the first time and I have had it at home, will probably just explore it, touch it, press it. A child who has some experience with clay will go on to do something with it. They may mould it into make a birthday cake, or they may mould it into something. And then a child who has a lot of experience with clay will do even more with it. They may create a scenario where they bring little animals in. They might create a whole play scene around it. So it's always useful to think, in even a small group activity, will all the children succeed? And the more open-ended the material you're using, the more every child will succeed, you know, with what they're doing.
Because that's very important now, because we're seeing a lot of rooms, a lot of services that, because of the EC, that they've brought in like 2 years and 8 months.
Yeah.
And, you know, not all services have individual rooms for different age groups.
Yeah.
And also, because of teaching and the levels required, that you may have a level 8 experienced leader and you might try and put as many children into that room because of the extra fees. And,
sure.
You know, so, you know, realistically, you know, as a service provider, sometimes you may, this is how you have to do it. So you may have 2 years and 8 months, or maybe even a little younger if they start. With a five-year-old, especially in January, February, because all our four second years are coming to a bit older, and they play completely different.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, completely different. The way they use that clay is going to be completely different. So for a practitioner or a leader of a room, how do we adapt that? You know, how do we find those open-ended materials? And that, you know, the younger children may last 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And the older children might last 30 minutes or be there an hour later, you know. So how do we do that?
Well, thinking about open-ended materials, so things like fabrics, blocks. If I could only have one thing in a preschool room and they said, you've got to get rid of everything else, you can only have one material, I'd go with blocks. Good set of blocks, because they can just become anything. And all children will engage at their level with blocks. You'll never go wrong with a set of blocks, some small world play, anything that can be used in more than one way. But even painting, rather than using, if I could do one thing, I would ban all templates. If I could have one wish for young children, I would say plain pieces of paper, value scribbling. All marks, all literacy begins with scribbles. Mm-hmm. So even an activity or an experience, rather than an activity, has a connotation of an end result. If you want to put out just paper and pencils, you will have the very young child will scribble, which is actually very valuable, because you have to scribble a lot to make letters. All letters come from, there's a scribble alphabet by Rhonda Kellogg. It's very interesting. You can display a scribble alphabet and children's scribbles, because we don't generally value something until we can recognize it. But just scribbling is great. And then older children will engage with the pencils through representing, through drawing. So again, that's a very simple experience that you can have a two-year-old do, three-year-old, four-year-old, and they'll all do something completely different with it. You know, painting, printing, anything like that. As long as you use plain paper, you're absolutely on a winner.
And what would you say to the opinion, going back to templates?
Yeah.
I know everybody has a different opinion on this, and you do see it in services and things like that. So say if, we went to the zoo last week.
Yeah.
And some of our children, their first language would not be English. So it's very visual learning at that point. So before we were going, or sometimes we wait till we've had the experience. So let's say after Halloween, after Christmas, or after a snowy day, we don't talk about snow because they don't understand it till it's here. So
sure.
You know the way we, it's no point in doing snow or the frog when it has no relation to the child. And you might actually use a template to explain the tiger, to get that communication going, or the variable going, you know, or that it kind of, okay, this is a tiger, Loretta's saying it's a tiger, I seen a tiger, this is, the, you know, so it's kind of following on. So I know some schools would use templates to help in visual aids. So is that still...
Do you mean before you went to the zoo, you showed children pictures of tigers? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, and we would have had templates of a tiger or a hippo, and they got to choose which template they would like, and they would colour it in and cut it out. And then, you know, when they come back, they would realize, and then you do a big picture on your own. So it's just like kind of that you're using templates as a visual aid. Is that even not allowing children
I would say I'm really all about balance with most things. If I was going to a zoo, I'd probably show them pictures of a tiger. I probably wouldn't use a template to let them colour in. Now, saying that, some children love to colour in. They find it very relaxing.
They do, yeah.
And they love to cut out and they find that relaxing. Other children don't, you know. So you might have it on offer and maybe a child will engage with it. Sometimes the problem that I've seen with templates is, well, first of all, children find it difficult to find their own work sometimes. If you ask them which is yours, they struggle to know which is theirs. And other children then get anxious. So you'll always have children that wonder with the template, what does the adult want? What if I go outside the lines? Another child might point out, but she's just scribbling on that.
That's right.
So you bring a lot of those kind of, let's say a group of eight children. Three children, if they do colour in a tiger, might enjoy it. Three children might be completely bored with it, you know. And two children are not engaging it at all. And two children might be quite anxious about what the adult wants. So again, it's back to that idea of knowing your own children. But I mean, that would be my experience of templates.
Yeah,
like I would absolutely, if I was going to the zoo, show children a wide variety of the animals they're going to see.
Yes.
And when they come back to represent them, I would put pictures of those animals on the table, because they have then a visual representation that they can work from, and the detail that they give is generally rather than just relying on what they remember. So you can use props, like often if we used to, the children might draw dinosaurs, we'd put some dinosaurs out on the table because it would support their
creativity and their memory of, you know,
their memory of it. And it's really interesting. We had a digger outside the preschool once and we all went out to visit and it was great excitement and the children came back in and it was fascinating to see what aspect of the digger. Some children only drew the bucket. One child only drew the tires, another child drew the door. So different things about an experience will capture children's interest. And it may not be, it might just be one aspect. It might be the stripes on the tiger.
Yes.
It might be something completely different. Yeah. It might be an ice cream they got.
Yeah, or just the whole page in black.
Exactly.
You know, down the middle. Yeah.
But by just staying with, again, that idea of just paper and pencils, you're getting again a window into their thinking. Why is the bucket fascinating for that child? Why? And you can have a discussion around that. You know, they don't need to draw the whole, you know, why is the door or the steering wheel or the wheels? You know, again, the more it's given us that window into their thinking again.
No, it's really, because it's unclear sometimes, you know, about the template. And I know there's reasons why people don't use it and we don't generally, but it's really interesting for it to be explained simply.
Yeah.
You know, and then it goes back to the whole play is freedom.
Absolutely.
And, you know, drawing is part of open-ended material. And then if you're giving you a blank page and pencils, there's no expectations.
Absolutely not. And you will develop then. Like once you see an image of something, that kind of says this is the way to do it. Once you see an image, and then what happens with children often is they say, will you draw a cat for me? Because I don't know how to do it.
Yes.
They lose their confidence in drawing. And then you might have to, if you've been used to using templates, you might have to go back and say, well, what does a cat have? And does it have a head? And you might start there. Sometimes children are just stuck at where to start.
Yeah.
You know, or you might say, you might choose your pencil and say, oh, here's the cat and he's chasing the mouse and do it, you know.
Yeah.
But again, it really is about, there isn't a right way to do it. They will develop as the more they engage with plain paper and pencils, they'll develop their own skills as an artist without saying, I don't know how to do that because that's how it's meant to look. So that would be my biggest critique around using templates is it gives you, this is how a heart should look. This is how this should look. They'll come around to that themselves. And again, it's back to that idea of trusting in children, their competence, you know, really important. And we have to explore, how much do we trust them? How competent do we think They are.
Yeah, and to allow them that freedom again to do it, to explore their own play and creativity.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's through creativity. If you think of the working world, Google offer opportunities for adults to be creative. They've placed spaces. I think in Australia, they've called FedEx days, where an employee can go off and work on anything that interests them. And they bring it back then to the workplace. So it's not just for children. I think about 80% of Google ideas, like Google Mail, stuff like that, have come from people going and exploring these ideas. But that's how you're creative. You need the time, you need the space. Most important, you need the freedom. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really important for that.
And Mary, did you find, recent articles about the after schools, you know, because the new scheme is coming in.
Sure.
And after schools, thankfully, are now included in areas. Yes,
great.
Is great. And I think it's very important. So do you ever realise that at some stage the importance of play goes from children? You know, so like you're saying, you know, Google have, you know, doing this FedEx days, that they realise the importance of play for adults. But you will always, I've often seen children that go, God, when you did have they'd be in my preschool and he was such a great player. Oh my God, he used to get the game going and he'd have them all falling.
Yeah.
And then you see them at 7 or 8 and they've no interest in play. So is it important that we carry it through? Like
we really need to explore why that is the case. You know, why a child that's so curious, so motivated, like, what is it? What are we doing to children, really? That at 7, you know, that spark is dying already. I mean, I think there's a question there for us and a huge area to explore as to why that might be the case, you know. But I do think, I mean, I know my own children even, like they're 22 and 18, and when the nieces and nephews are around, they still all play tag. You know, and tip the can, and you know, with
you
their younger.
You get into your childhood very easily,
absolutely.
Don't you? Because it's fun, you know.
Therapists use sand play and will find that it's a really quick way to bring adults back, you know. And it's down to us again. And I know we were talking earlier and I was saying, we take some things so for granted, like the way we set up environments. Mm. You know, why do we have to set them up in interest areas? Materials are much more important than interest areas, because materials, when you interact with the material, it provokes a certain reaction. So a small ball of clay will provoke a different response to a big mound of clay. Materials we need to think about as having nearly, I know Reggio talks about the environment as the third teacher. Mm-hmm. I would say materials are the third, or at least should be there as the fourth teacher, because you might have an interest area that nobody engages in, you know. So really much more thought needs to go into materials, I think, and back to play
again.
To
initiate that play.
Absolutely.
To get the child interest so that, you know, especially in September when children are only coming in for the first time, especially the younger children, that could be the first time they leave their parents.
Sure.
You know, it could be the first time that, you know, they have the problems of transition in the first place because they're leaving their mums. And as you said, that security, that is it, like in the toddler group you were talking about. And I keep looking at my mum to see, is it okay if I keep moving in? And that's only for an hour and a half. All of a sudden, they're in there for 3 hours. They're with older children. They're with two or three adults they don't know or haven't spent that much time with.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, they're bombarded with a home corner, a book corner, a quiet area, construction area. I don't know, you know, fallible area, sensory area. And it's a lot to take in. So I often see children in the very early stages working aimlessly.
Absolutely. And again, they have to develop that secure base. Wherever they are, they've developed security in it. So again, even the parent-educator relationship, that they know my mom is happy with this person. I'm looking for her cues. This is a safe place for me to be left. When I then feel secure in my group with maybe my key worker, hopefully, it's only from then I can explore. Because I'll go back again, only one or other of those systems is switched on. I feel secure and I can explore. I don't feel secure, I don't explore. All the research will say that. I know a lot of the research has been done on mammals, and a lot of research has been
diddly
done.
Rat or whatever.
And rats as well. But still it shows that, but we do have, once the security is there, we will. And again, you'll have different children with different temperaments, much more anxious, slow to warm children who need more time. Again, that comes to observation. The easy, the happy-go-lucky child who's quite, you know, relaxed, and then the feisty children who need to engage with everything and take on roles as leaders. So that's again down to us to understand their temperament. And the sensitive child particularly, I think the feisty child gets a lot of attention, generally the sensitive child, because they don't demand any attention. But yeah, basics, I mean, it's really simple, really. You know, yeah. So simple, it's hard to teach nearly, yeah, in some ways, you know, but that idea of that free play, those materials, thinking about the materials we bring in, thinking about the affordances they offer children, what opportunities they offer children, really, really important. Yeah.
Oh, Mary, wonderful. We could sit here and chat all day.
I know.
Seriously, I know you have to fly off. But I'd like to thank you very much.
You're very
and
welcome.
I don't think this is the end that we're going to see each other. I think I'll be dropping up to Mayo. And I actually thought you were based in Galway, so... the next time I'll come to you and we'll have a cup of tea there.
Great.
And thank you very much.
And thank
and
you.
Continue your love of play.
Yeah, thank you, Loretta. Thanks a million.
So there you have it. On to the next time. This is your host, Loretta, telling you to take care and be kind to yourself.